This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. This is also our annual Webathon week, when we ask listeners like you to make a tax-deductible contribution to help fund our journalism. If you like what you're listening to, please go to reason.com/donate and make a tax-deductible contribution. We really appreciate it. Everyone talks about online speech, but when today's Reason interview guest, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai, has something to say on the topic, the whole world pays attention. In October, Pai said the FCC would be looking to clarify Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, the controversial law that governs the internet and social media. Even though he's announced that he's stepping down on January 20th and that Congress has ultimate responsibility for passing laws governing online speech, what Pai does in his final 2 months in office could have a lasting impact. Section 230 is also known as the Internet's First Amendment and the 26 words that created the Internet. The law gives Internet service providers, website operators, and social media platforms broad permission to host user content without being held legally liable for what those users say. It's the reason, for instance, that Yelp doesn't have to sweat being sued for defamation every time somebody posts a lousy review of a restaurant. It also allows them to moderate comments and content how they see fit without incurring the same liability as publishers of newspapers or TV stations face. Democrats, including Joe Biden, say that Section 230 allows social media to publish hate speech and disinformation that ruin elections. In January, Biden said that 230 should be revoked immediately. More recently, on October 14th, President Trump attacked Facebook and Twitter for preventing the distribution of a New York Post story about Hunter Biden, and he demanded in all caps that we, quote, repeal 230, end quote. The following day, Pai released his statement, saying that social media companies have a First Amendment right to free speech, but they do not have a First Amendment right to a special immunity denied to other media outlets, such as newspapers and broadcasters. I spoke with Pai right before the Reason Foundation, the think tank that publishes this podcast, awarded him the 6th annual Savvis Award for Privatization for his market-friendly policies, such as facilitating the growth of 5G networks and ending net neutrality, the FCC regulation of internet service providers that had been put in place during the Obama administration. In our conversation, I asked Pai what sorts of reforms or revisions of Section 230 he was thinking about in his statement, what he was most proud of accomplishing at the FCC, and whether he thought free speech, especially free speech online, had much of a future in a polarized America. Here is the Reason interview with Ajit Pai. Ajit Pai, thanks for talking to Reason.
Hey, great to be with you again, Nick.
Okay, so we're going to talk about Section 230 in a bit because that is what everybody is kind of going bananas over right now. But first, let's talk about your achievements as commissioner or as chairman. In September, you gave testimony to the House Communications and Technology Subcommittee. And in that, your office compiled a 14-page list of your accomplishments to date. You said in your testimony, my top priority since becoming FCC chairman in January 2017 has been closing the digital divide. How is that going? What kind of progress have you made, and what is yet to be done on the digital divide?
Yeah, no, we've made a lot of progress on that top priority. And over the last 3.5 years, what we've seen is millions more Americans having access to the internet. And even now, that number is going to go down further because we're in the midst of the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, a $20 billion reverse auction program through which we're allocating this money to unserved parts of the country through the market mechanism, not just by cutting a check to a fly-by-night operator and saying, vaya con Dios, but using the auction mechanism that Ronald Coase pioneered almost, 60 years ago now to distribute that
funding. Walk me through that a little bit. So, you know, we're basically right now, the people who don't have, the best or access to the highest levels of broadband tend to be in rural areas or on Indian reservations, places that are kind of far away.
Yeah.
How does an auction, for services or anything, how does that help them?
Yeah. So for context, when I came into office, the traditional model was the FCC has these universal service fund programs. It essentially cuts a check to a rural telephone company, and there's no accountability on the back end. Those rural telephone companies didn't have a strong impetus to use that money to build out the networks, especially in these rural or native lands. And so what we did was to set up a reverse auction where we encourage all kinds of companies using any technology, so long as it meets the FCC service thresholds, to compete for that funding. So we'll say for a certain census block, for example, this is the amount of money that we estimate will be available. Anybody from electric utilities, satellite companies, cable companies, telephone companies, whatever, compete for that funding. There's downward pressure on prices using the same market mechanism that will hopefully make sure that the best technology for that area will win ultimately and deliver a fiscally responsible result.
What is, for a kind of standard, internet package, what would that be? 25 megabits downstream, 3 megabits upstream.
Yeah.
What are the percentages of Americans who don't have kind of easy access to that level of broadband?
That's a good question. So our estimates are that something like 18 million Americans don't have access at that particular speed. And those are the parts of the country that we're targeting with the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund. But what's significant is that 25.3 figure you stated. That is the FCC's definition for broadband. But in this reverse auction I just talked about, we've actually put a thumb on the scale in favor of much faster speeds. In fact, gigabit fiber, for example, or gigabit service of any kind, would get preference over a 25 megabit per second bid. So that's the kind of thing we're trying to do to future-proof these networks. We don't want to sit there and give people something that seems like a Ferrari today, but might be a buggy whip tomorrow.
What else are you most proud of in your achievements? I mean, you foregrounded in testimony, closing the digital divide. What are the other top things? And again,
I would say promoting American leadership in 5G. I mean, we have pushed an unprecedented amount of spectrum into the commercial marketplace, both through auctions for cellular licensed spectrum and for unlicensed spectrum Wi-Fi. In fact, we pushed out more spectrum over the last 3.5 years than any FCC in history. So this is a huge market-based achievement, I think. Additionally,
For the layman, and by that I mean for me, can you dumb that down a little bit and say, 5G is capable of doing what? And then how have you made it more likely that 5G service is going to be deployed more quickly?
Yeah, so we executed the 5G fast plan, which I outlined a couple of years ago. And there are three basic parts to that plan, which correspond to the basic inputs to a 5G network. Number one, spectrum. You need to have airwaves to transmit this data. Number two, wireless infrastructure. The 5G networks of the future will look very different. Instead of big cell towers, you'll see many, many different small cells that operate at lower power. And then number three, promoting more fiber deployment. Fiber is going to be critical for carrying all of that internet, wireless internet traffic into the core of the networks. And so on each of those different points, we've been really aggressive. A spectrum I just talked about, but even on small cells, making sure that state and local and tribal governments don't erect unnecessary regulatory roadblocks or extract exorbitant fees. Same thing with fiber deployment, getting rid of utility style regulation and encouraging companies to focus on fiber as opposed to copper investments. That's the kind of thing we've been doing to encourage 5G networks.
Could you talk a little bit about some of your critics? And one thing that's fascinating about the 5G or your kind of initiatives on 5G is that you're finding allies among people who generally are calling for your head on other things. And then even people within the Trump administration are like, what is this guy doing with 5G? He's overstepping his reach and he's going in the wrong direction. One thing that came up early with 5G deployment was the idea that local areas, particular cities or residential or political jurisdictions, were going to charge a lot of money because they knew that if somebody needed to get through there, they would be able to get a lot more money for that. Your stance was more that this should not be something that is really subject to a kind of federalism where every town can kind of charge what it wants for utility pole access and things like that. Is that accurate? And what's the rationale for that?
I think the rationale overall is that anybody, whether you're a big established company or a startup, you need to have a consistent level of regulation when it comes to this inherently interstate service. So you're building a communications network doesn't happen solely within a state or even within a city. We're talking about communications that traverse state boundaries. And it follows from that, I would argue, that only the federal government has the power to set a consistent national policy. And to the extent we give all of these different levels of government a bite at the regulatory apple, federal, state, local, tribal, we are inhibiting companies from raising capital, hiring the work crews, and building these networks. And that capital and talent is fickle. I mean, China, South Korea, other countries are eager to seize the mantle of leadership. So you know, the time is long since passed, and we can just rest on our regulatory laurels and think companies are going to invest no matter what the burden is.
So talk a bit about the, you know, China comes up a lot in discussions of 5G. How does America maintain leadership, like global leadership in 5G or whatnot? I mean, because we're not talking about Chinese companies coming in and investing in U.S. infrastructure, right? So what is the... You know, what do you mean when you say the U.S. needs to, you know, lead on 5G?
Well, I would draw an analogy to 4G. So because the United States led in terms of setting a market-based framework for 4G innovation and investment, companies were the first to build 4G networks here. The mobile app economy sprung on top of that, primarily here. And so when I came into office, for example, in 2012 as a commissioner during the Obama administration, we had 4% of the world's population, but 50% of the world's LTE connections. That's the same type of leadership we want to show in 5G, which is, if anything, going to be even more transformative. And so I think the first mover advantage is significant here. Our role as the FCC is not to pick winners and losers, not to say that, you know, this company will win, this company will lose, or even to build networks ourselves. It's to put in place the building blocks for market-based innovation, which is exactly what we've done.
Right. And but on another level, you are privileging 5G. I mean, that's, you're clearing the decks for that technology, because that is the next thing. And then it's a question of which companies succeed or fail in actually rolling it out in a way that customers
I would actually quibble with that. So actually what we're doing when we auction the spectrum, it's flexible use. So companies can use it for anything they want. Moreover, on the unlicensed side, we've had a 5x increase in the amount of mid-band spectrum available for Wi-Fi and things like that. That is open to anybody. You don't have to pay for it at an auction. And that's 1,200 megahertz, a huge amount of spectrum that, you know, the wireless industry wanted us to auction. But we said, no, it's important to have a home for the innovators who don't want to have to come hat in hand to the FCC and beg for spectrum with their dollars. It should be open to any innovator. And that's exactly the kind of mixed use, I would say, the flexible use on the licensed side, the unlicensed innovation on the Wi-Fi side that we think is going to generate American leadership now and into the future.
What are the big fears if China becomes, you know, the world leader in 5G? Why is that a bad thing other than, you know, kind of national pride?
Well, I think, you know, clearly the Communist Party of China has a determined view that they want to lead in certain technologies. 5G is one of them. And so they've picked national champions, both in terms of network operators and in terms of infrastructure providers like Huawei and ZTE. And your 5G sits adjacent to other technologies, artificial intelligence, machine learning, quantum computing, et cetera. And so I think they want to combine all those technologies to make China the dominant force in driving technological innovation. And you know, if they can succeed in setting the technical standards, driving all of the use of 5G in the early days, over time, that first mover advantage will accrue to them. And I think it's going to sync up rather unfortunately for us and for other freedom-loving peoples around the world with all kinds of bad effects that I don't think we want to see. You're surveilling exactly what people are doing and for what purpose, subjecting all kinds of wireless operators to requests from the intelligence services, which China requires domestic carriers in China to do. That's not the kind of thing we want to see exported. And over the last years, you know, I mean, they've been more than willing to export their anti-free speech, anti-freedom vision on things like basketball and flag emojis. I don't want to see that happen with 5G, which is going to underlie everything from our transportation network to the healthcare system.
What's the best use, or not the best use, but what is an exciting use of 5G that will actually, you know, because a lot of times, you know, everybody's talking about this is not simply one more click up the wheel from 3G, 4G, et cetera. You know, how is it transformative?
I think from a consumer perspective, some of the early use cases we'll see are things like telehealth and connected care generally, just getting super high resolution, low latency, in other words, very responsive connections between patient and provider. Gaming is another one as well, where now if you're able to free the console from a wire that goes into a screen, that's a big deal. And so that's all augmented reality, virtual reality, that sort of thing. On the industrial side, I know it's not as sexy, but the improvements in terms of efficiency and safety and productivity are going to be tremendous. Connected cars, for example, or precision agriculture, increasing the yield in an environmentally sustainable way. All these types of things are at our fingertips if we get it right on 5G, and I'm really confident that we will.
What do you make of people that are freaking out over, and thank you for the comically oversized Reason mug,
good product placement.
Reese's Reason, you know, it's in the neighborhood. What do you make of people who are freaking out over 5G and claiming that it, you know, it causes cancer, that it is a kind of secret surveillance, et cetera? What do you do with that?
Well, look, we've seen this during past technological transformations. In fact, I had my staff look this up. We saw the same concern. We went from 1G to 2G, 2G to 3, 3 to 4, and now, of course, 4 to 5. And some of my favorite tweets are when I get, yeah, you're going to just kill us all with 5G, and then you check the signature line, it's, you know, sent over a 4G iPhone connection or on my Android phone. And so the thing we've tried to focus on is the facts here, working with the FDA and, you know, other healthcare experts who have the primary jurisdiction here. We've established that the FCC's limits for radio frequency or RF exposure are safe for 5G just as they were for 4G. And so we're really confident that what we're doing here is safe and will enable consumers to be better off in the end.
Let's talk about net neutrality. That was when you assumed the chairmanship, that was really the kind of topic du jour. Briefly recall, because we haven't heard a lot about that, and that I think is partly a success story since the Trump administration and you rolled back net neutrality rules. Can you recap the net neutrality drama and what are the lessons that we should be drawing from that controversy?
Yeah, it does seem like ancient history now, doesn't it? Which is telling, as you pointed out. I mean, back then in 2017, when I announced that we were going to move to reduce government involvement in internet regulation, you know, restore the market-based approach that had served us well from 1996 until 2015, some people were freaking out. And we saw predictions that this was the end of the internet as you know it. You're going to have to pay $5 per tweet. Certain websites are going to be inaccessible. And, you know, fast forward now, almost three years, internet speeds today are twice as fast as they were in December of 2017 when we made our decision. As I pointed out, millions more Americans have access to the internet. If anything, the internet is better than ever, especially during the pandemic when internet speeds in the United States increased by 10% on the fixed side, 4% on the wireless side. Compare that to Europe, which has the net neutrality regulations that certain advocates in the U.S. love. Because they've had subpar infrastructure investment over the last couple of years due in part to these regulations, they had to go hand in hand to these, you know, streaming companies, YouTube, Netflix, Hulu, et cetera, in the early days of the pandemic and beg them to throttle content from HD down to SD. So if you're a European consumer, now you've got the worst of both worlds, this heavy-handed utility-style regulation of the internet and services that are throttled because the government that rules you has said, we don't think that our infrastructure is able to keep up the load. So I think we made absolutely the right decision. And the fact that it's now receded into the background of most people's memories is, I think, testament to the fact that we did the right thing.
Give a mark on the United States kind of communications and technology, online technology services, for how they've done through the pandemic and the lockdown. Are we getting it mostly right or wrong? Where are the big sticking points? What are the big successes?
I actually think we're doing really well. I will say in late February, early March, when it became clear that hundreds of millions of Americans were going to be moving to a work from home, stay at home environment, I was a little worried. I mean, that's a huge change in traffic patterns and the location of that traffic. But incredibly, the networks held up very, very well. In the middle of March, I initiated what I call the Keep Americans Connected pledge, in which I asked broadband and telephone providers to not disconnect consumers from service. And they did that and were able to do that, even though there was a huge increase in the amount of traffic and they weren't, in some cases, getting paid. So it was incredible to see that even with the huge increase in internet traffic, something like 25 to 30% increase in traffic on the fixed side, 15 to 25% on the mobile side, that even then they were able to withstand that because the architecture of the internet had been designed because they had regulatory certainty. They were able to build a lot stronger networks in the last 3 years before anyone even heard of COVID. So to me, I would argue one of the best stats is that internet speeds on average went up on the fixed and mobile sides during the pandemic, which you wouldn't expect if there was a creaky, crappy internet infrastructure out
there.
Well,
let's talk about what has replaced net neutrality as the topic du jour, which has to do with Section 230 yeah. of the Communications Decency Act, which is also, it's a little, well, it was formerly a little known provision dating back to the mid-90s that has been called the 26 words that created the internet. Could you briefly describe what Section 230 is and why is it causing so much consternation?
Yeah, so Section 230 is a part of the Communications Act, which, of course, the FCC administers. And in part, Section 230 was amended by the Telecom Act of 1996. And in 1996, members of Congress essentially established that interactive essentially online providers of content, if they were moderating the platforms in good faith, and were removing content that was otherwise objectionable based on that good faith standard, essentially that they would be immune from liability for suit, and a couple of other provisions as well. So I think, especially as the internet, as a lot of the public square has migrated to the internet, a lot of people are debating, well, should we revisit how Section 230 operates?
And to give a kind of mundane example of Section 230, it's the provision so that Yelp can exist, and Yelp is not sued when somebody leaves a review of a restaurant saying, you know, this restaurant made me sick, it was, awful, the worst food ever, things like that. And the restaurant owner could sue that individual user for libel or defamation, but they can't go after Yelp. Yeah. Is that accurate?
Right. That's the traditional characterization of Section 230. Right. That's right.
So you have mentioned, and this was in October, you made a statement that got a lot of press, and noting that there is bipartisan support in Congress to reform the law as we are talking this week. I'm not exactly sure when our conversation will go up, but Jack Dorsey of Twitter and Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook were testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee about Section 230. But you made a statement in October saying there's bipartisan support in Congress to reform the law, which there is, and that the FCC has the authority to interpret Section 230, and that you would clarify what it means. And in that same note, you said social media companies have a First Amendment right to free speech, but they do not have a First Amendment right to a special immunity denied to other media outlets, such as newspapers and broadcasters. So clarify, where are you on Section 230? If it's got to be clarified in some way, what are you thinking?
So that last quote that you just offered is exactly right. So under the current law, both the First Amendment and Section 230 itself, the FCC does not have authority to regulate social media companies directly. This not like AT&T, for example, or companies like that in the telecom space. But the immunity provision is different. That is a part of Section 230, which is in our Communications Act. And as our general counsel pointed out in a very eloquent blog post, which of course I can't and won't replicate here, has pointed out that under established law, the FCC has the authority to say, okay, what do these terms mean? What does good faith mean? That kind of thing. What we propose to do is not regulating social media companies, is simply saying, should we have a conversation about what these terms mean? Is it ambiguous? Is it not? If it is ambiguous, how should we interpret it? So it's focused only on that immunity provision, not on the larger questions of direct regulation.
So can I ask, what the hell, you're drinking out of a Reason mug, you just got an award from Reason, and so I'll put you on the hot seat then. Donald Trump, as well as Joe Biden, have both been critical. They say they hate Section 230. Do you think that Section 230 is being used, the situation that it creates, to stymie conservative voices? Donald Trump got very mad at Twitter when at various points. For instance, earlier this year, when mail-in ballots were going to become, recognized as they're going to be going out everywhere, he tweeted something along the lines of saying that, mail-in ballots will be fraught with fraud and, phoniness and all of that kind of stuff. And Twitter attached an information tag to that, saying that, this may be false or misleading, or here's more information. Should Twitter not have done that, or should they not have the right to do that under Section 230?
So that is a question in terms of what 230 should allow that is squarely within the purview of Congress. And that's exactly the debate that Congress is having. Should we revise Section 230 to address those types of situations? Joe Biden, of course, has campaigned on repealing Section 230 altogether. So our role here is relatively circumscribed. All we are doing is proposing to look at the immunity provision itself and to see whether or not terms like good faith require clarification. So
you would not necessarily be, when you say you're going to have a conversation or you're going to look to clarify, what does that mean? Are the commissioners going to kind of, duke it out over what should be a kind of new policy, or what's going on?
So traditionally, the way the commission operates is through the notice and comment process under the Administrative Procedure Act. We issue a notice of proposed rulemaking, we get public input on that notice, and then we proceed, if appropriate, to a report and order where we make a final decision. And so what I announced in October was I intended to move forward with a notice of proposed rulemaking. All Americans will be able to read it in advance. It will be able to comment on it. And so in you're fully transparent, we want everyone to have a chance to comment on what it is we are thinking about.
Can you kind of preview what you're thinking about doing?
No update yet. Obviously just announced recently that we intended to move forward with it. And so we're working with the staff is looking at the record that was compiled in response to. So what happened was the Department of Commerce filed a petition with the FCC on this very issue. And so in the course of that, we said, OK, American public, tell us what you think about that petition. So we have a bunch of comments that have already come in and they're sifting through those comments to figure out the way forward.
Can I, you know, one of the things that has become a kind of, you know, the conversation about Section 230 often boils down to, and this is people on the right and the left saying this, that, you know, you can either be a platform where you're a neutral framework and, you know, that would be that Facebook would just allow people to post whatever they want and they wouldn't use algorithms to guide people to information that they like based on, you know, past searches or anything like that. Or you can be a publisher and then you are liable for everything that's on the site. Do you think that framework is, I mean, is Section 230 ambiguous about that? Or is it just that people are mad at Section 230 because they perceive a platform like, or an organization like Facebook is putting its thumb on the scale to tamp down this kind of speech and amplify this kind of speech?
See, that's a really interesting question, because I think what underlies that whole debate is a concern about transparency. If you go back 3 years, almost to the day, I gave a speech in which I said that a lot of these social media platforms aren't transparent about what algorithms they use, how they essentially decide what goes and what doesn't go. And a lot of the problems, and this is back in 2017, mind you, well before all these debates we've been talking about. Back then I said that I think American consumers expect in many cases to understand a little better, how are these companies making these decisions? And I think that concern has only been accentuated over time.
Okay, so can I ask, you know, in your fellow commissioner, also on the FCC, a Republican, Brendan Carr, in Newsweek published a story in July of this year, and he basically said that, you know, what needs to be done, and he seems to be much more aggressive and overt about wanting to either revise or change 230 completely, but that we need transparency, accountability, and user empowerment on social media platforms or online. So when you say transparency, I mean, do you agree with that idea that we need to beef up transparency, accountability, and user empowerment?
Well, it depends on what particular solutions one might have in mind. But I do think that transparency addresses a lot of these issues. And, you know, I quite often see that, you know, why is this tweet allowed but not that one? You know, I tweeted out a couple of months ago, does the supreme leader of Iran's tweets where he says we want to destroy the state of Israel and get rid of the Jews and that kind of stuff. What is, how do you make the determination that that isn't a threat of violence? And I certainly would expect the most reasonable people would think that is indeed a concrete threat. And so that's the kind of thing.
I guess two questions immediately, like should that kind of speech, because this is also from the left or on the liberal side of the aisle, people like Joe Biden are saying, you know, we need to get rid of hate speech. And they believe that Section 230 is getting in the way of platforms, you know, really being serious about getting rid of whatever is defined as hate speech. You know, should that kind of speech be allowed on Twitter? Should, you know, should the president of Iran or, you know, or a world leader or just a garden variety nut job, should they be able to say whatever they want online?
So that is a substantive question that is certainly beyond my bailiwick. But I think what is important here is the transparency question. I think if people understood the process by which the companies were making those decisions, then at least you could agree or disagree with that particular deployment of an algorithm.
Okay. And transparency would be first off whether or not certain things are being tagged at all, but then also whether or not certain things are being suppressed and other things are being kind of blasted out. So, I mean, transparency would be what? That the platform would need to kind of explain how their algorithms work and why this type of content is going to get this sort of treatment and this type of content is going to get something else.
So many people have come up with different solutions, but I think the gist of it is show your work, as my math teacher used to tell me back in fifth grade, we know that you reached this conclusion, but what was the reason that got you there? And I think that's something that would serve everyone in the internet economy well, regardless of, you know, the statutory framework.
So related to that, then, is accountability. And what, you know, what would accountability look like coming out of, you know, from your point of view, what does that mean?
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for Commissioner Carr. You know, he might have very different views from other commissioners on this issue. But, you know, I do think that, as I pointed out in a blog that I put out in 2018, when the tech giants first started coming to D.C. to testify, is I would just like them to explain.
And by the way, it's worth pointing out they came to testify in 2018 to a person saying it's time for us to be regular.
Right. So that's, you know, and now we've, of course, seen a series of hearings in 2020. But I think, you know, what I would like to see is more accountability in terms of, you know, showing your work. And I think that I know it's, you know, beating on the same drum of transparency over and over again. But, you know, when it came to net neutrality, one of the things we did to inspire consumer confidence, and I would argue quite successfully, is that we instituted a strict transparency rule on all internet service providers. And we said, look, you have to disclose all your network management practices, your business plans. If you're thinking about doing paid prioritization, you have to disclose that up front on a website or at the FCC's website. And so now, whether you are Comcast or Amplex Internet in Lucky, Ohio, consumers are going to know in advance exactly what the rules of the road are. And so I think that's the kind of thing that I'm talking about here, where if there's upfront transparency, I think generally speaking, Americans can work around that and understand that. Whereas now it's sort of a black box into which people import all of their preconceived views or perhaps mistaken views about what's going on and what's not.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that Facebook, for instance, is actually like squelching what they consider conservative points of view? I mean, are things like shadow banning, you know, is that true? And is it ideologically motivated?
So, I mean, I've heard arguments on both sides that, yeah, yes, they are. No, they aren't. But I mean, it's not in any form or fashion that I could say I can make a really informed judgment about it. It's been more, you know, people battling like on Twitter, you know, and things like that. So, I'd have to know with a more sound factual foundation, one way or the other.
How does this kind of intersect? And I realize I'm grilling you here but you know, how does this intersect with things like political speech and political advertising? One of the things that Section 230 was designed to do was to, you know, first off, not to hold internet service providers or content providers and websites responsible for stuff that people post on their sites or their services. So that kind of frees up speech, and we understand why that kind of facilitates it. And then another big part was that those same providers could, you know, moderate content however they see fit without being accused of being a publisher and hence responsible for everything on the site. Do we want a world in which the government is kind of telling internet service providers or social media platforms or individual websites, you know, what kind of political speech is allowable or not?
Right. That's a very good question. And that's what I think is one of the very interesting ironies, is that some of these same social media platforms were badgering the FCC for years to adopt very strict net neutrality regulations, purportedly because of the concern that internet service providers would be metering speech, would be deciding this consumer can or cannot access this political website, or will not be able to speak about this political issue. That's kind of, I wouldn't say schadenfreude, but it's kind of interesting, I would say, that now these social media companies themselves have been accused of doing exactly that. And so, you know, again, that's the policy debate on Section 230 that is going on in Congress. In fact, you probably saw the hearing just recently that they had with Twitter and Facebook, in which this was one of the, you know, hot button issues that the senators are trying to hammer out. And I don't see any easy resolution to that issue politically on either side of the aisle. They each come to it with a different gripe.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and again, I mean, at the same time that Trump is saying, I can't reach people, as many people as I would expect to on Facebook, Democrats, you know, were saying, or liberals were saying that because of Russia, the way Russian bots and the way Facebook refused to kind of squelch speech, Trump won the election in 2016. So there's, you know, a lot of noise, but not, or a lot of heat, but not necessarily a lot of insight on any of that. Are you confident, regardless of how this plays out, that the government of all people and that Congress is going to be able to rule with a light touch? I mean, the hallmark of your administration and, you know, has been a light touch towards regulation, both of technology as well as of kind of speech. Where do you think that ends up?
It's a good question. I mean, certainly, you know, the only wand that I can control is the one I hold. And so I would like to think that over the last 3.5 years, we've been very consistent in saying that at the end of the day, markets, as opposed to the government, deliver far more value to American consumers. And whether it is a spectrum auction or the deployment of infrastructure or the content that goes over the internet, that generally speaking, what we've tried to do is enlarge the square, make sure that the markets, as opposed to the markets based on the aggregated decisions of millions of individual consumers, as opposed to someone like me, is the person making that determination. I don't want to be, and I don't think the FCC should want to be, sitting there as the Solon making all these decisions.
Right. The third leg of the stool of kind of Section 230 reform that gets kicked around a lot, and I think you believe in this too, has to do with user empowerment. What does that mean in this context, and what would that look like in terms of policy application?
I will confess, I didn't see the commissioner's remarks on that point, so I don't.
Forget. I don't want you to channel Brendan Carr, but I guess when we get to a point of saying the story about Hunter Biden that the New York Post ran, that Twitter, famously a couple of days before the election refused to allow people to even link to, which seemed to me an egregious violation of what I expected Twitter to be. I don't remember them ever doing that before for any other story, actually. But by the same token, it also helped create a massive amount of interest in that story, and people found it not on Twitter. Later in that same day, one of the biggest stories on Twitter was the New York Post story about not being allowed to link to the other story on Twitter. I guess what I'm getting at is like all of these attempts to kind of enforce a standard system of fairness and of transparency and all of this, they never quite work. And in the end, we're just left with whether or not users can be trusted with information wherever they get it, and whether it's tagged with something saying this isn't really true or this may not be true, or saying this is the God's honest truth. What is the role of media literacy or in the end, whatever Brendan Carr thinks, but of user empowerment in kind of understanding how the internet works?
Yeah, and this is one of the areas where, I've obviously been pretty busy the last couple of months, but I would like to go back and listen to some of those hearings where, if I remember correctly, Jack Dorsey was asked questions along these lines of, how do you decide what users are allowed to link to and what they're not allowed to link to. And I just haven't had a chance to see what exactly his answer was. But I do think at the end of the day that, look, when users are going on the internet, they don't distinguish between who's running the network and who's running a social media platform. What they would like to know is, am I able to get my message out, and am I able to get information? And so I think ultimately, the more they understand the rules of the road, the better off they are and the better off the entire internet economy is. And we've done our part at the FCC with respect to internet service providers. And I've tried to highlight the importance of this issue on the social media side as well, even if, as I said, the FCC doesn't have a direct regulatory authority here.
Do you feel like we've reached a kind of moment, and I guess with something like bipartisan, transpartisan calls for, Section 230 reform or, abolition and rewriting and things like that. Have some of the, the large categories about, kind of freedom versus regulation and things like that, are they just no longer kind of mapping onto what's going on?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, I've certainly thought about that in terms of some of the values that you and I have talked about before. I mean, free speech, freedom of association, and some of the core, yes, they're constitutional values, but I think they're actually also sort of cultural undergirdings to the West. I mean, this is the Enlightenment, effectively, what we're talking about here. And I do think that overall culture has frayed quite a bit, and that, now I routinely, over email or Twitter or whatever, get a lot of, you're not doing enough on this and you're not doing enough on that. And it's regardless of the political affiliation of the person making the complaint. And I think that, it's a very unusual time. I mean, things are much more fluid than they were when I came onto the commission in 2012, when one sensed, generally speaking, that the battle lines, were relatively clearly drawn.
What do you gaze into a crystal ball? And obviously in technology and the internet, more than anything else, you have no idea what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, much less the next 5 or 50 years. But do you see, it seems to me that broadly speaking on the internet, there is a clampdown coming. Both individual platforms are flexing, Twitter is bouncing more people than it used to. Facebook is, allowing and disallowing certain types of speech in a way that they really weren't doing 10 or 15 years ago. You know, in other ways, people seem to be less interested in hearing opposing points of view or to accuse people of lying about everything. Do you think that's going to continue, or what pulls us out of that? And, you know, what are the technological policy decisions that would actually allow us to have more and better speech?
Boy, I mean, that's a PhD dissertation right there. I mean, I think, I'll just speaking for myself, not necessarily speaking for the commission. I mean, my goal has always been to broaden the reach of technology, both the means of accessing communications networks and the ability to speak over those networks in a way that will allow every person to be fully empowered to express his or her own views. And so it's kind of odd to me that at the very moment when I think we're making great strides to realize that promise in terms of access, that our culture seems to be fraying in terms of the importance of that public square where opposing views are heard. And, you know, that quote misattributed to Voltaire, I might disagree with what you say, but I'll fight for the deaths for your right to say it. I mean, what do you think the percentage of Americans who would agree with that now is? 20%, 25%? I mean, I certainly count myself among their number, but it's very telling to me now that a lot of people have said, you know what, forget it. You know, the pluralistic vision of the public square is effectively over, and let's just become a tribalistic nation where you pick your tribe and then you go at it. And I very much am worried about where that's going. And I hate to say it because I'm generally speaking an optimistic person by constitution, but I am pessimistic about where this goes in the future, that everyone is looking for the slightest hint of hereticism from the other side or even from their own side and looking to penalize it. That's just not the America that I want to see. I mean, I think that we've grown up, generally speaking, most of us, with a culture of free speech and free expression. And I think we've often taken that for granted. And once that culture frays, who puts it back together? I mean, it's not going to be a politician. It's not going to be a regulator. It has to be the aggregated decisions of millions of Americans to say, no, we want pluralism again.
There, and, in a kind of dogmatic libertarian argument, and I'm not, I think of you as a libertarian fellow traveler. I don't want to, pin, another tail on you, that you're a hardcore libertarian. But there's a kind of dogmatic libertarian argument that would say a service like YouTube, a service like Facebook, Twitter, these are private entities. And so they can, they can set the rules however they want. And if you don't like it, leave, go start your own platform. And we're seeing that with, failed attempts like Gab as an alternative to something like Twitter and Parler, which is seems to be picking up some steam. Should that be carrying the day in terms of protecting speech? Because on another level, the minute that the government is going to say, and people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz, conservative Republican senators, have started moving towards the notion that something like Twitter and Facebook, because it has become the public square, because it is so powerful and so many people are on it, it really kind of needs to be regulated like a public utility. Are these the only two ways to think about things?
Well, I think for that vision to prevail, certainly many would argue there would have to be a change in the law to subject platforms like that to utility style regulation. Oh,
certainly, yeah.
And so, and that's why we focus, as I mentioned, simply on that narrow question about the immunity provision, as opposed to the broader utility style regulation questions that some have suggested. So,
it's kind of ironic. I mean, Ted Cruz, as an individual, was very hostile towards net neutrality, saying Democrats wanted to bring back 1930 style public utility regulation to the internet of all things. But now he's kind of calling for something similar. Is that an irony that we should kind of linger over before we move forward?
That's interesting. That's obviously a political question that I think people would have to evaluate. But for our purposes, at least, we're just focused on, again, that narrow question. And you will leave the larger political ones to people like senators and representatives elected to make those decisions.
Well, let me ask this. You have one of the best Twitter feeds on the service, on the platform, I think.
Thank you.
And I encourage everybody to look it up. It's wide-ranging, and one of the things that I actually find genuinely interesting about it is that it's filled with retweets. It's not simply you kind of extemporizing on every issue of the day. You link constantly to things like Red Letter Days and the U.S. Patent office and trademark office and things like that. So that's very good. But have you, like, how do you teach your children to use the internet? And is there a lesson there for the way that, you know, all of us should be kind of both, you know, be more thoughtful, but also kind of more responsible for our own, you know, our own thoughts and our own actions?
Well, that is a great question. So even as a very avid user of the internet, and in particular social media platforms, thank you for the shout out to Ajit Pai, FCC. I'm glad someone likes the drivel that I put out on that feed. But, you know, what I've told my kids is, you know, the internet is a really powerful tool, and it can be a tool for good. You know, right now my kids are relatively young, so they'll come up with a question, you know, what killed the dinosaurs? And that will take us down a nice little, you know, rabbit hole in terms of the asteroid that hit, you know, Shishkaloob 66 million years ago and that sort of thing. But I've also said, look, the number one goal that we are trying to instill in you as your parents is to be a really kind, thoughtful, genuine person. And so, you know, don't let some of the tendencies that people can develop over the internet, being mean to people because of the physical distance or the anonymity, you don't let that, you know, take you to heart, take you down. Or and, you know, there's a chat page on one of my kids' classrooms, and every now and then one of the kids will put a really mean comment in there, not directed at my kid, but, you know, my kid will notice it. And he was asking me, like, why did this person say that? And and I had to explain, that's probably
not. And you say, because they're a Democrat.
Hopefully they don't. The fact that some people claim that their kids have political affiliations at nine is part of the reason why we're in the problem that we're in. But I honestly believe that. It's like, you know, just leave the politics out of it until they get older. But no, but what I said is, do you think that this person would have said that if the other person was in the room, in the classroom with him or her? He said, well, no, probably not, because they seem to be friends. I said, that's exactly right. So never mistake the internet for sort of the real world, or don't let it guide how you treat other people. You know, think of it as just try to capture the benefits of it in terms of the acquisition of knowledge. You know, compared to when I was a kid, every fact that has ever been accrued in human existence is at your fingertips. That's amazing. But don't let the downside of it accrue as well. And, you know, it's hard. Obviously, I'm sure, you know, younger people are much more digital native than we ever were. And so they're imbibing this stuff 24/7. But to the best we can, to the best of our ability, we want to be able to insulate themselves from that until they're mature enough to understand, you know, what it is. So I know it's a losing battle and it's a very imperfect answer, but that's how I think about it.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for talking. Chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, winner of the latest Savas Award for Privatization from Reason Foundation. Thanks so much.
And most importantly, the owner of a very major new mug, not Reese's, but Reason. Free markets, free minds, and good coffee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. Okay. Good to be with you.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. It's also our annual Webathon week, so if you are interested, please go to reason.com/donate and give us a tax-deductible contribution that'll help fund our journalism and our podcasts. Thanks for listening.